Hey everyone, I'm Dan Kortler, the host of TED Climate. Each episode, we unpack the problems and solutions of climate change. This season of the show, we're getting into some big ideas that make us optimistic about the future, like meat grown from cells and leather made from mushrooms. And the best part? We look at how building a greener future can be an upgrade instead of a sacrifice. Find and follow TED Climate wherever you're listening to this.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Bob McDonald. Welcome to Quirks and Quarks. On today's show, the romance of science. Biologists sort through 40-year-old cans of fish to understand the life of an ecosystem.
It was smelly. Some of the cans showed a little bit more degradation than others. What we ended up doing was basically picking through every one of these cans of salmon with tweezers.
And why the gentle ape might not be.
It's pitch dark, it's 5 a.m., and I see two bull of fur in the trees, and one is rushing toward the other, yelling, it's crying, it's scared. And I'm like, what is going on?
Plus, how Mars affects the Earth's oceans, the source of silver in medieval purses, and the long-term impact of COVID on the brain. All this and more today on Quirks and Quarks. If you're opening a can of salmon for your lunch right now, we apologize in advance. You've been warned. You see, a few years ago, a young marine ecologist was looking for a way to study the history of parasites in the marine ecosystem off Alaska. But she was a little short of data for her study. The biological samples she needed hadn't been collected by scientists in the past. And then she got a call. And pretty soon, dozens of cans of elderly salmon, some of them with best before dates from decades ago, showed up on her doorstep. And it turned out that this was an important, if a little nasty, bounty of scientific information. Dr. Natalie Mastic is a postdoctoral researcher of marine ecology at the Peabody Museum of Natural History at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. Hello and welcome to our program.
Hello, Bob. Thank you so much for having me.
How did you come upon decades worth of old canned salmon?
By a very lucky chance. The lab that I was working in, I was in Seattle, Washington. We had been doing a lot of projects looking for old parasites in old fish. And so we had been using unusual sources already, including museum specimens, to look for parasites. And when we were approached by a seafood inspection company called the Seafood Products Association, who said that they had decades worth of canned salmon in their basement that they had stored. I guess we were probably thinking, this seems like it could work, but maybe this is going to take some testing and it could be really gross.
Now, how old were some of these cans of salmon?
The oldest cans of salmon came from 1979.
So. Wow. So what was it like when you opened them?
It was smelly. Some of the cans showed a little bit more degradation than others.
So then how did you go about figuring how to test these cans for the parasites that you were looking for?
Great question. So we didn't know if we would find parasites, and we didn't know how to look for them. As parasitologists, we have a couple of tools that we have used in the past to look for parasites in fresh fish. We tried both of these methods with the canned fish, and neither of them were very effective. Because, as you can imagine, cooked salmon looks a lot different than raw salmon in terms of transparency. So what we ended up doing was basically picking through every one of these cans of salmon with two pairs of tweezers and finding worms that way.
So what did they look like inside the canned salmon?
Kind of like muscle filament of the salmon. So if you were just preparing a can of salmon for, I don't know, a salmon salad or a sandwich or something, you really wouldn't notice them. They're the exact same color as the salmon, and they have about the same texture as the muscle.
But are they alive inside the can?
They are not. They are completely dead. The cooking process in canning makes sure that all of them are killed in the process.
Okay. What kind of life cycle do these parasitic worms have to end up in salmon in the first place?
So these parasites have a complex life cycle. That means they have multiple hosts that they need to infect. And the general life cycle of these parasites involves they're kind of a free-floating worm in the water, and they get eaten by a zooplankton, so like a krill or a copepod. And then that zooplankton gets eaten by a small fish. And inside that fish, that worm develops a little bit more. And then it gets eaten by a bigger fish, where the worm develops a little bit more. And then it finally gets eaten by a marine mammal. And in the marine mammal, the nematode is so happy. It grows to its adult stage. It reproduces. So it sheds a lot of eggs, and then those eggs get deposited back into the ocean through the marine mammal's poop. So that continues the cycle over again.
Boy, it really works its way up the food chain.
It sure does.
And then back again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So once you went through more than four decades worth of canned salmon, what did you see in terms of the level of parasites or any patterns?
So we ended up seeing that there has been an increase in these parasites in two species of salmon, in pink salmon and chum salmon, over this 40-year period. We did not see the same increase in sockeye and coho, which were the other two species that we looked at. And that could be due to differences in the parasite species that we were unable to identify. So we weren't able to identify the parasites to a species level, but we were able to identify them to a genus level. So we might be seeing one species of parasite that's increasing that doesn't necessarily infect sockeye or coho.
Okay.
In the same way.
But you're saying that in the chum and the pink salmon, the levels did go up. So what does that mean?
That could mean a couple of things. One of the ways that could happen is if there's an increase in one of their hosts in the marine environment. The Marine Mammal Protection Act was passed in the early 1970s, and that protected all marine mammals in Alaska. So that protection allowed a lot of marine mammal populations to increase, which could have boosted the reproductive capacity of these worms, because all of a sudden, they had more of these final hosts to infect and more opportunities for them to live out their entire life, reproduce, and put more eggs into the environment.
Oh, I see. Because these worms use the whole food chain from krill all the way up to whales, their presence, how does that suggest the health of the ecosystem then?
That actually, it kind of seems counterintuitive because parasites, we humans usually think are a really bad sign. But in terms of ecosystem health, this is a really good sign because it means that all of the hosts that these complex life cycle parasites need to just get to their reproductive stage are available and they're abundant enough for them to carry out their entire life cycle, enough to not only live but increase in population size.
So should people send their old canned food from their basements in for further research?
Absolutely. I think that this kind of study can only happen when somebody that's interested in a very strange topic gets very lucky when somebody tells them that they happen to have a collection of cans or sometimes other data in their basement. So if you have anything fish related from, you know, the past 5 years or on, that would be, feel free to reach out. I'm sure a lot of people would want to dissect them.
Okay, well, we'll give out your address for people to send
oh,
things
great.
To. just one last thing. Has this turned you off canned salmon?
I have not eaten fish since like 2007. I'm vegetarian, so this did not change my eating behavior whatsoever.
But the important thing is that the stuff that you did see in the salmon was very old and it was dead.
Yes. Yes. So this does not in any way make canned salmon more dangerous to eat. You've been eating these worms without knowing it forever. So this shouldn't change anyone's behavior.
Okay. Dr. Mastic, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Bob. This was fun.
Dr. Natalie Mastic is a postdoctoral researcher in marine ecology at the Peabody Museum of Natural History at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. We've long known that the moon has an effect on the Earth's oceans. As the moon orbits our planet, its gravity causes bulges in the oceans, resulting in the regular rise and fall of sea levels that we know as tides. The sun has a similar effect. But a new discovery is showing that these aren't the only celestial objects influencing our oceans. Mars, even though it's on average 225 million kilometers away, is also having an effect, helping to drive giant whirlpools in the deep ocean. Although, unlike the moon's daily effect, this pull from Mars comes and goes in cycles that are millions of years long. The surprising discovery was made by a team including Dr. Dietmar Müller. He's a professor of geophysics at the University of Sydney in Australia. Hello and welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
It's my pleasure.
Now, before your study, what did we know about Mars' effect on the Earth?
Well, we did know that planets can affect climate cycles on Earth. But the planets that usually have this effect are Jupiter, Venus, etc. They're much larger, of course, and their gravitational attraction is much larger. But Mars, we didn't know what effect it had. There were predictions from astronomical models. So every 2.4 million years, the Earth gets a little bit closer to the Sun because the eccentricity of the Earth's orbit around the Sun gets perturbed by its interaction with Mars. And so that means that every 2.4 million years, Earth is getting just a little bit warmer than at other times. And there was a prediction made by astronomical models that this should happen, but the phenomenon has been rarely observed in geological data.
Well, tell me how you worked with ocean currents to figure this out.
Yeah, so we compiled data from sediment cores from the ocean basins. We've had something called the Ocean Drilling Program, and it's been going on for over half a century now. So there have been hundreds and hundreds of holes drilled in the seafloor, sediment cores retrieved. And so normally, of course, the paleoclimatologists will study the detailed properties of these sediments. But what we did instead, we focused on the sediments that aren't there. They are the gaps in the sediment record. And so what happens is that sediments on the seafloor can go missing. They're first deposited, but then they might be picked up by strong deep sea currents and deposited somewhere else. And so we compiled all the gaps that we could find right across the ocean basins and put them all together into one giant time series. And we discovered that there's this 2.4 million year signal in these data. So every 2.4 million years, these hiatuses, these gaps become more frequent. There's more of them.
Well, yeah. What's happening in the ocean currents that's causing these gaps?
Yeah. So that's a very interesting question, right? Many of us would have read stories in the news and that the weather is becoming more extreme, right? Many of us would have experienced that ourselves, right? So as the Earth is warming at the moment, we've got more weather extremes. There are more cyclones in the oceans. And one of these things that the cyclones cause is they cause very deep-seated eddies. They're like giant whirlpools in the ocean. And some of them reach all the way down to the abyssal seafloor, and they end up causing turbulence on the seafloor, and they whirl up the sediment and transport it away and deposit it in some other place. So these gaps in sedimentation give us an idea about how vigorous deep ocean circulation has been.
So are you saying that if they're started by cyclones, they're driven by the weather, the extreme weather that stirs up the ocean?
Yes, that's what we think. So astronomical models predict that every 2.4 million years, the Earth receives a little more insulation energy from the sun. So every 2.4 million years, the Earth gets a little warmer. And what we observed is that at these very times, we find more intense deep ocean currents. There's more sediment that's being moved around in the deep ocean. And we think this makes sense because just over the last three decades, as the world has been warming up because of human interference, right, we have seen a similar effect. Right? Cyclones are becoming more common, large ones especially, and we see a more vigorous eddy-driven deep ocean circulation. Right? And of course, we are causing this effect over a very short period of time right now. But before humans existed on Earth, Earth's interaction with Mars caused a similar effect much more slowly over long periods of time.
Well, what's the arrangement with Mars, the Earth, and the Sun that causes this cycle every 2.4 million years?
The relationship that we have is driven by something that's called the precession of the perihelions of Earth and Mars. So that's quite a mouthful. Mm-hmm. Now, the perihelion is the shortest distance of a given planet from the Sun. And every 2.4 million years, the arrangement between Earth and Mars and their gravitational interaction is such that Earth gets pulled a little closer to the Sun with a very eccentric orbit.
Oh, I see. So Mars pulls on our orbit and makes it more elliptical, more football-shaped.
That's exactly right. So as the orbit becomes more elliptical, you get a larger difference between the seasons. But you're also increasing the time that the Earth spends a little closer to the Sun.
So where are we in that 2.4 million year cycle now?
So we have actually geologically relatively recently passed a minimum. About 200,000 years ago, we were at a minimum insulation and a relatively cool climate, one could say. And so we are now moving into the next positive cycle, but we'll have to sit around for about a million years until we hit the next maximum. And so maybe humanity will be lucky enough to still be around at that time.
Okay. Now, we've talked a lot on our program about concerns that climate change is having effects on ocean circulation now. What does this discovery mean for that process?
We know that in the geological past, there have been times when we had great extinctions of life happening because of ocean stagnation, where the ocean becomes layered and not very well mixed at all. So you don't get oxygen or other nutrients into the deep ocean, right? And so we think there's a good news item embedded in this, that our analysis shows that even far back in time, when there were no ice sheets at all on Earth, and the climate was much hotter, the oceans were still well mixed. Hmm.
So Mars is the straw that stirs the Earth's drink.
Yes, one could say that. That's a very nice analogy.
And if the circulation shuts down, it has a backup plan.
Yes, indeed.
Dr. Mueller, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Dr. Dietmar Mueller is a professor of geophysics at the University of Sydney in Australia. In today's world, money can take a variety of forms, like electronic bank transfers, credit cards, and even cryptocurrencies. But you don't have to be that old to remember a world when cash was king. Paper money dates back just over 1,000 years. Coins have a much more storied history, along with the various metals used to make them. One example is 7th century Anglo-Saxon England. At that time and place, there was a shift from gold coins to a sudden boon in silver coins. Modern-day archaeologists have so far found over 7,000 of these silver pennies, all minted between the years 660 and 750. This surge in silver has long puzzled researchers who wondered where the silver came from and how it got to be so widespread. Well, now, thanks to modern technology, we have the answer. Dr. Rory Naismith is a professor of early medieval English history at the University of Cambridge in the UK. He was part of the team behind the work. Dr. Naismith, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much indeed, Bob. I'm happy to join you.
First of all, tell me about these silver coins. What were they used for?
Well, they were used for lots of things. They were used for buying and selling. They were used for giving gifts, for paying compensation and paying fines in legal contexts. They were used for broadly everything that money is used for now.
What do they look like?
They're very small. Each one is about 10 millimeters in diameter, which is to say about the size of an adult fingernail. But they are quite thick and quite chunky, so they weigh about a gram to a gram and a half of silver.
And how much would each of them have been worth at that time?
Very hard to say for sure, but probably a few tens of modern dollars or pounds. So it's not exactly small change, but it's a lot more versatile than the gold coins that had been used before, which were worth about 10 to 14 times as much.
Wow. So they weren't just used by aristocrats, they were used by everyone.
That's exactly right. There are so many of them that they simply can't have been the preserve of elites, aristocrats and churches, people like that. And there is some textual evidence which shows that they'd be being used by peasants, by all kinds of people.
Well, why was it so mysterious to you as to where the silver coins came from?
Because it was clear that there was a huge uptick in the amount of silver in circulation, but there was really no good evidence, textual or material, as to where that supply of silver came from. We didn't know if it was one source or many, and we didn't know when it came online. And so that was what brought us to do this new round of research.
Well, are there no big silver mines in England?
Not in England, no, at least not in this period. There was an important silver mine in western France at a place called Melle that was starting to become important at about this time. But in fact, our results show that Melle is probably not a major source for England or its neighbours in eastern and northern Francia at this time.
So how did you go about figuring out the source of the silver coins?
We did two things. One was both of which involved what's called laser ablation analysis, which is taking a laser and applying that to a tiny point on the coin and going through the outer few microns of the surface. And that's important because the outer layers of coins like these are typically enriched either through leaching of metal in the soil or sometimes through production processes. And this means that you have to get a bit further in to get a stronger sense of what it's made up of as a whole. At the same time, these are historically important artifacts. You don't want to be cutting huge, huge swathes out of them. So this does abrade only a tiny, tiny area of the coin, a fraction of a millimeter in size, so it's invisible to the naked eye. And by doing this, we got information about the composition of these coins, what is in them, what elements are in them, in what proportions. Obviously, silver is the main one, but it's the trace elements, the ones that are there in smaller quantities that tell us a bit more, because these often reflect the original characteristics of the ore that the silver was sourced from. And we can do the same thing with the lead isotopes, which was the other major metric we used.
Okay, so once you blasted these coins with your laser and analyzed the chemical composition, what did it tell you about the source?
Well, it showed us, first of all, that there was a large degree of homogeneity across eastern England and the northeastern part of mainland Europe. And that's important because wherever they're getting the silver from, it was broadly the same in this fairly large area. The second thing it told us was what the profile of this silver was. And we saw immediately that this did not map onto the silver that was known from Mel. It did not map onto any other known mines in Western Europe. And it was also quite different from the silver that was used in the late Roman period in Western Europe. What it did map onto was the silver that was being used in the Eastern Mediterranean at about the same time in the 6th and 7th centuries in the Byzantine Empire.
Wow. Well, how did silver from the Eastern Mediterranean get to England?
Our thinking is that probably it had come over in other forms a bit earlier than when these coins were made. And that's because we know that there is very little silver coinage or silver objects being made in the Byzantine Empire in the late 7th century or after. There was also very little contact with Western Europe at that stage. On the other hand, there is plentiful evidence for trade and diplomatic contacts with Byzantium earlier on in the 6th and 7th centuries. And in a famous Anglo-Saxon ship burial from a place called Sutton Hoo in Suffolk, there was a whole spread of Byzantine silver. There was about 10 kilos worth of dishes and bowls and spoons, enough to have made about 10,000 of these coins if you'd melted them down.
Oh, I see. So it's not that the coin, the money itself was going from the Mediterranean up to England. It was goblets and plates and artifacts that came from that were brought to England.
Exactly so. Yes, they're not coming over with ingots that they take straight to the mint. They're coming over with objects that had probably been kept in people's homes, well, in high-class people's homes and in all sorts of contexts where they'd be used for display and for sort of symbolic demonstrations of wealth, but not monetized as such. That's the change that comes on in the late 7th century.
Well, why would people do that? Take these valuable artifacts made of silver and say, hey, let's make some coins out of them and give them to the common people.
That's exactly the question. And our answer to it is that there are a wider range of economic changes taking place at this time. You can see that towns are growing. You can see that pottery is being produced and circulated in larger numbers, in larger quantity. And this all suggests that it's becoming more advantageous for people with silver to monetize it in this way. Basically, they're able to deal with affluent peasants, craftspeople in a more profitable way, and this is leading them to turn their stockpiles of silver plate into silver coin.
So it's the equivalent of printing money. They were actually making their own money.
Pretty much, yes. It looks like at this time it was not really the preserve of the king to make coins. It was up to whoever had the silver on hand, they could just decide to make it into coins that would look like how they wanted to and which they could use for whatever they wanted to do.
So what does that say about the economic development of that period that required handy currency?
I'd say it shows that we're looking at an economy which is more complex in that people are dealing with a wider range of partners in markets and where markets themselves are becoming more important, where you want a more versatile form of means of exchange. I think it also shows us that for all that there was this rapid development, it was also still a very granular, very haphazard in some ways kind of economy where you've got this large degree of freedom for actors who just happen to have the silver and who want to use it for their own benefit.
Amazing. Dr. Naismith, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Dr. Rory Naismith is a professor of early medieval English history at the University of Cambridge in the UK.
I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, host of The Big Story. For 6 years now, we've been telling one story a day, every one of them about something that matters to Canadians. This spring, though, we're going deeper. The Big Story presents Pay Dirt, the inside story of Ontario's Greenbelt scandal. From political games to stag and doe parties, endangered species, RCMP investigations, and Las Vegas massages, you will hear the full story. The Big Story presents Pay Dirt. New episodes every Monday, and you can get them all by following The Big Story wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Bob McDonald, and you're listening to Quirks and Quarks on CBC Radio 1. Coming up later in the program, COVID and the brain. We're learning more about the impact of the pandemic on the way the brain works, and it's not happy news.
There are long tails to pandemic, and infections have long tails. And yes, we can focus all we want on the acute phase or the tip of the iceberg, but the reality is that there is really a much larger chunk of disability and disease beneath that tip of the iceberg.
They are our closest primate relatives, but bonobos and chimpanzees have a lot more than genes in common. They look similar. It can be difficult to tell them apart by their size and color, and both species live in the tropical forest in large communities. But when it comes to behavior, the apes have a very different reputation. Chimpanzees are known to be violent and will kill while defending their territory or attacking others. Bonobos, on the other hand, are generally thought to be a more peaceful group of, quote, love monkeys. And yes, I know, they're apes, not monkeys. But results of a new study challenge these behavioral assumptions. A team of scientists followed both chimpanzees and bonobos in the wild and compared their aggressive encounters. Anthropologist Maud Mugino was part of the research team. She's a postdoctoral researcher at Boston University. Hello and welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, why were you interested in studying aggression among chimpanzees and bonobos?
First of all, I personally was interested by this because of humans and how humans use aggression. So humans can be very aggressive by doing warfare, for example, but also very tolerant by living in society of millions of inhabitants. And I wanted to study how we evolve such an interesting paradox. And for this, I actually was interested in studying bonobos and chimpanzees, our closest living relative.
Why those two ape groups in particular?
Actually, because chimpanzees are have this reputation to be more aggressive. They have aggressive intergroup encounters. So male will make coalitions and defend their territory. And sometimes when they find one male alone, they might attack and kill this male. And in bonobos, actually, group can encounter and they can spend time together, sharing food. Sometimes they can cooperate with each other. So I was really interested in looking at how aggression might have evolved in those two species.
So how did you actually study bonobos and chimpanzees to see how aggressive they are in the wild?
So we used male focal follows. So focal follows is following one individual an entire day.
Trying to follow primates in the wild must be really difficult. How did you actually carry out the study?
Field can be very tricky. You have to like waking up early. Usually we wake up around 3:45 a.m. Walk for an hour and a half to go to their nest because they're sleeping in nests up in the trees. And we wait for them to wake up and we just follow them the entire day. And we take data on what they're doing. The field for bonobos, the forest is extremely thick. And sometimes we need to use shears to go through it. They spend some time on the ground, but they also spend some time in the trees. And those trees are really high, so you need to always have binoculars. It can be really tricky because you can lose your focal and it's taking forever to find it back. They like crossing rivers from time to time. And for them, it's not a problem because they go through the trees. But for the humans behind them, it's kind of very, very tricky.
Now, if they're up in the trees and you're down below on the ground, did you have stuff falling down from the trees?
Yes. So when they wake up in the morning, the first thing they're going to do is pee and poop. And so your aim in the morning is actually avoiding being below the nests. But that happened to me to unfortunately be below a nest and I've been pooped on twice, I think.
And that's how you start your day.
Yes. And, you know, you can't go back to camp. You're there for the entire day. So you have to deal with it.
Where were the areas that you studied them?
So for bonobos, I studied them in the Kokolopori Bonobo Reserve in the Democratic Republic of Congo. This is the only place where we can find bonobos. The chimps, I went to the Gombe National Park in Tanzania. The site is pretty famous because this is where Jane Goodall have done all her studies.
Well, if you're following these primates around all day, you must have seen some interesting encounters. Can you tell me about some of the different situations that you saw?
There is one moment I really remember. It was my first week and I didn't recognize yet all the bonobos. And it's pitch dark. It's 5 a.m. And I see two balls of fur in the trees and one is rushing toward the other. And there is one that is fleeing and it's screaming and it's yelling. It's crying. It's scared. And I'm like, what is going on? And one of the field assistants look at me and is like, oh, this is an aggression. And I'm like, it's 5 a.m. They just woke up. And I remember, like, I probably 1 or 2 hours later seeing another aggression. And I really, like, put things in perspective. I was like, I'm not really sure about the peaceful bonobo anymore. There might be a lot more to it.
Wow. Okay. So you were expecting them to be really nice to each other, but they were actually aggressive. So how different were the aggressive patterns between the chimps and the bonobos?
When we compare the data we had on bonobos and chimpanzees, we actually found that male bonobos, when they act aggressively against another male, they're more aggressive than male chimpanzees. And for bonobos, they were specifically focusing their aggression toward other males. In chimpanzees, male were acting aggressively against other male, but also against females. In bonobos, male try to avoid acting aggressively against female.
Did these results surprise you?
They did. I mean, I was expecting to see some aggression, and my prediction was actually that we might observe like as much aggression in bonobos and chimpanzees, but I was not expecting the trend to be so high for bonobos. I was actually so surprised that I have my tables, you know, to analyze my data, and I was like, I did something wrong. And I repeatedly did those tables like 20 times at least to make sure they were right. I even look at each aggression one by one to be sure that I didn't do anything wrong. But those results were still the same.
Well, given the aggression that you saw, do you think bonobos deserve their reputation as, quote, love monkeys? I mean, apes?
I think the peaceful bonobo or love bonobo, it's a little bit reductionist. It's very simplistic. And those species have a very nuanced behavior. They use a variety of strategies. And of course, aggression is one of them. And they use aggression differently than chimpanzees. And they have also other behavior. They can form those close association, and they can also affiliate with females, and they encounter between other groups.
Now that you've looked at aggression in two different non-human primate species, how does that change how you view aggression among humans?
I think aggression is a strategy, and it is used differently according to the context and as costs and benefits. For example, bonobos are more individualistic, the males at least. They do not form coalitions, so they have different costs and benefits of using aggression compared to chimpanzees who form male coalitions, which can be really risky for them then to act against another male because they might face a retaliation. Or if they act against another male, it might be a potential partner to defend their territory. So aggression is more unpredictable for chimpanzees and might be more costly. And I think it's allowed us to rethink how, with the humans' coalitions, how those coalitions might affect our use of aggression and might push us to use other strategies. Also, I think actually for me, studying aggression specifically really make me rethink our use of the word model. Some researchers and people might think like, oh, we're more chimpanzee-like or we're more bonobo-like. And I think we're not like them in the way that we all went through our own evolutionary path. All the three species have evolved differently. And I like more the idea of comparing strategy. Oh, we see this strategy and this strategy. What does that mean? How does that evolve? And I think this paper really helped me to understand that we don't have a best model.
Dr. Mugino, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Maud Mugino is an anthropologist and postdoctoral researcher at Boston University.
Since recovering from COVID-19 last year, Sonia Malley still suffers crushing fatigue and says her mind is trapped in a fog.
I'm a fraction of the person I was before.
Malley can't focus, struggles to remember, and has lost the creativity that inspired her art.
It's sort of like trying to trudge through neck-deep sludge, except mentally. You're tired, you're confused.
When COVID-19 first reared its ugly head back in 2019, it brought with it many strange symptoms beyond its too often deadly respiratory problems. One of the most puzzling is what it seemed to do to the brain. You're probably familiar with the frequent complaints of brain fog, cognitive issues like confusion, forgetfulness, and trouble focusing. But a foggy mind is, we're learning, far from the only impact COVID has had on the brain, even when all other signs of illness are mild. Recently, several new studies have been published that look at the range of uncommon but troubling effects of COVID-19 on the brain, looking at how it disrupts the blood-brain barrier, how it affects brain volume, and showing that even a mild case of COVID can lead to the equivalent of years of brain aging. One of the researchers studying this is Dr. Ziad Alali. He's the chief of research and development at the VA St. Louis Healthcare System. Dr. Alali, welcome to our program.
Well, thank you for having me. Delighted to be with you.
First of all, how common is it for a respiratory disease like COVID to cause many other issues around the body?
I think the short answer here is that COVID sort of gave us a magnifying glass to try to understand how viruses can affect the nervous system. COVID is unique in the sense that, you know, it's a pandemic, you know, with billions, with a B, billions of people got infected within a short span of time. And it's really relatively a novel virus. You know, if you rewind back to 2019, SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19 did not exist on Earth. These two characteristics, including, you know, the scale of the pandemic and the novelty of the virus, sort of almost put a magnifying glass under COVID-19 and helped us see that SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, can also lead to brain problems. But that's really unlikely to be just unique to only SARS-CoV-2.
Well, take me through some of these effects that COVID has had on the brain. What have you seen?
The cardinal manifestations, one of the key manifestations that people experience after SARS-CoV-2 infection, is what we call colloquially as brain fog. That's really the mental haziness, the inability to remember things, to connect the dots, to really think through clearly. That really characterizes, you know, a lot of sort of the clinical course of people after SARS-CoV-2 infection. And in addition to that, in addition to sort of this brain fog, you know, people can experience strokes, headaches, seizure disorders. When we've done research on this, we characterize about 44 different complications can happen in the brain or the nervous system as a consequence of SARS-CoV-2 infection. So contrary to its name, Bob, contrary to its name, where R supposed to sort of, you know, describe respiratory problems, this is a respiratory virus. So contrary to its name, SARS-CoV-2 is not only a respiratory virus, it's a virus that can enter the body via a respiratory route. That is true, but then can wreak havoc in multiple organ systems, you know, chiefly among which is the nervous system.
Boy, 44 different effects. That's astounding. Can you give me some examples of what it does to the brain?
Sure. So in addition to brain fog, we see people coming back to the clinics with mini strokes, sometimes coming back to the ER with strokes. We see headache disorders, a lot of people with headache disorders after SARS-CoV-2 infection, sleep disturbances, sleep problems, tingling. You know, a lot of people come back to the clinic with tingling of the extremities, you know, tingling in the legs or sometimes in the arms. In rare cases, seizure disorders. So really a variety of health problems in the brain. In total, about 44. But really, again, the chief or the most common manifestation is brain fog.
So is COVID actually affecting the way the brain functions? Is it making people less smart?
So, you know, there are studies that have been done of comparing people who got infected with SARS-CoV-2 infection or had COVID-19 versus people who didn't, and then gave them cognitive testing to measure their ability to cognitively process information and test their IQ, so to speak. And there's very clear differences in the IQ of people who had been infected with COVID-19 versus people who did not. A very, very clear difference in that even in mild COVID can give people about a 3-point decline or 3-point loss of IQ following SARS-CoV-2 infection. So very, very clearly that there is impact on, you know, the ability of the brain to, you know, function properly or function well. And we call that broadly cognitive dysfunction or cognitive impairment. The key caveat, Bob, to those studies is that, A, most of these were done in an era, you know, from the original phase of the pandemic when we didn't have vaccination, when the virus was very different and we didn't have antivirals. And two, we also don't really know whether that those cognitive losses that I just described, that 3-point IQ loss, we don't really know how permanent that is. Is that going to be, you know, last for a few months and then go away, and then, you know, the brain sort of restores its normal, you know, functioning and cognitive abilities, or will that be, you know, a permanent loss of a 3-point in IQ in that individual, and whether that might lead to early Alzheimer's disease or early dementia in people affected is also not known. So I think it's important to understand the science, and also really important to sort of caveat it by the limitation of our understanding at this point and the need for more research to try to, you know, gain a deeper understanding of the long-term ramifications or long-term consequences of the 3-point loss in IQ that generally characterizes people after the initial phase of SARS-CoV-2 infection.
What about brain aging?
That's very important. So a lot of studies have been done so far to try to, you know, some imaging studies and other modalities looking at the brain, you know, structurally. And it's very, very clear that in some individuals, they do experience, you know, structural abnormalities and some other abnormalities of imaging that are commensurate with what normal people experience with about 7 years of brain aging. And might those be reversible, Bob, down the road? I think we still don't really know. Is this really going to be permanent aging? Like, you just literally accelerated the aging of 7 years in the span of maybe just one? Or will that sort of really get better with time down the road? It's really unclear at this point. But I think what is very, very clear is that SARS-CoV-2 can affect the brain in multiple different ways. Now, the hope is that those effects that are not long-lasting, and then, you know, the brain with neuroplasticity and other sort of mechanisms will be able to, you know, restore itself back to normal health. But I think that really remains to be characterized and seen in studies.
What do you know about the mechanism? I mean, how is a virus that we're told comes in through the lungs affecting the brain so much?
So first of all, Bob, is really the misnomer. So yeah, we're told it really is a respiratory virus, but it's not a respiratory virus. It's clearly a systemic virus that can, you know, escape from the respiratory tree, so to speak, and also make its way to the brain and the heart and other organs. Two, you know, it induces inflammation of the brain. So what one of the, you know, clear, you know, signals from the studies that we've, you know, done and a lot of other people have done over the past several years is that clearly there is a neuroinflammation or there is inflammation in the brain of people with SARS-CoV-2 infection. Again, that's not everyone, but clearly in some people it can provoke inflammatory reaction in the brain or neuroinflammation, and that may explain some of the symptomatology that is experienced by some individuals. You know, three, it's very clearly it can affect, you know, multiple, you know, substances on which the brain really depends to function normally. One of them is cortisol. So people have studied this, out of Yale University and have shown that, you know, people with long COVID or people after SARS-CoV-2 infection can experience inappropriately low level of cortisol. And that's actually an important hormone that is really important for a lot of sort of normal physiologic processes, including cognitive performance, and sort of a lower cortisol level than where it should be can explain some of the cognitive dysfunction that is seen in some people after SARS-CoV-2 infection. There are some studies also done on it showing low serotonin levels in people with after SARS-CoV-2 infection, and that can also explain some of the symptomatology seen, you know, following the initial phase of SARS-CoV-2.
But doesn't the brain have a protective mechanism, the so-called blood-brain barrier?
This is exactly right. So we've evolved as a species, and we've evolved in a way that, like, the brain is the control and command center of our body. You know, we as a species evolved to protect it very well. So we don't only have a skull, but we also have what we call a blood-brain barrier. This sort of the lining around the brain that forms a barrier that protects it from any noxious substance that's trying to invade it. But what happens in SARS-CoV-2 is that by, you know, provoking inflammation of the brain, by inducing that inflammation of the brain, it actually makes that membrane or makes that barrier leaky. So it starts leaking things into the brain that shouldn't be there, and things from the brain to outside the brain that also should not exit outside the brain. So a leaky blood-brain barrier can also explain, you know, some of the manifestations that we see after COVID-19 infection.
How did you go about studying these effects of COVID on the brain?
So we run a clinical epidemiology group here. We do what we call a big data research. We have cohorts of about literally, you know, millions of people who had been infected with SARS-CoV-2, and we compare them to people who had not been infected with SARS-CoV-2. Now, it's actually hard nowadays to find people who had not been infected, but in the very early days of the pandemic, and also using historical control data from predating the pandemic, from a pre-pandemic era, we have a bunch of people, literally millions of people, who had not been infected with SARS-CoV-2 infection. And we follow people over time to try to characterize the long-term effects of SARS-CoV-2. We've done work to characterize its effect on the brain, on the heart. We've done a lot of heart studies, the digestive system, the kidneys, and the metabolic system, including risk of diabetes and risk of hyperlipidemia. And we've also done work to characterize the relationship between, you know, whether vaccines reduce the risk of these adverse events, and they do, and also to characterize the effect of antivirals. And antivirals, especially in high-risk population, also reduce the risk of serious adverse events. You know, reinfection, though, you know, repeated infection with SARS-CoV-2 is also not healthy in that it can actually increases the risk of complications.
How is this changing over time as the virus mutates?
You're exactly right, Bob. So, you know, we are in a different phase of the pandemic now than what we all experienced in March 2020. We have a different virus. We have availability of vaccines now. We have antivirals. So all of these drivers, you know, the changes of SARS-CoV-2 itself, the introduction of vaccination and the availability of antivirals have now sort of reduced overall the burden of long COVID, we think. You know, we're still sort of waiting for, you know, solid empirical data to sort of verify that understanding. But it's very likely that all these drivers combined, you know, sort of coalesce to, you know, support the idea that there is now less, you know, serious adverse events as a result of SARS-CoV-2 infection that we, you know, seen, you know, in the very early phase of the pandemic. That doesn't mean that, you know, SARS-CoV-2 infection is benign, is inconsequential. We still see people in the hospital with SARS-CoV-2 infection. We still see people with strokes and heart attacks and, you know, brain fog and all other manifestations. But overall, I think the risk, you know, has sort of declined over the course of the pandemic. Again, driven by not only mutation of SARS-CoV-2 itself, but also by the introduction of vaccination, you know, the idea that there is now quite a bit of immunity in the public sphere due to vaccination and the introduction of antivirals.
How unique are these other effects on the body and the brain and the heart to COVID? I mean, are there other diseases that cause long-term symptoms like this, but we just haven't been studying them as much?
This is exactly right. Is it really unique? Do other viruses produce the same thing? When we went back and sort of started, you know, thinking about what happened to people after the Spanish flu, we found historical accounts that sort of resemble to a large degree what we describe now after SARS-CoV-2 infection. People having increased risk of Parkinson's disease, you know, headaches, you know, brain fog, et cetera, et cetera. So I think we trivialize infections to our own peril. I think we didn't really appreciate very much their long-term adverse health effects that can come from these infections. I think one of the major lessons that I learned from this pandemic is that there are long tails to pandemic, and infections have long tails. And yes, we can focus all we want on the acute phase or the tip of the iceberg, but the reality is that there is really a much larger chunk of disability and disease beneath that tip of the iceberg. That's a long tail of things. And that's a lot of times is really hidden. People don't really look at, don't really appreciate.
Do you think it's possible to find ways to reverse these effects on the brain or find a cure to stop them from happening in the first place?
I am hopeful. I'm optimistic in the might of science. I'm optimistic that we've solved a lot of complex problems in the past, and we can and should be able to solve this. I think it's a question of like how much of a priority are we going to make it to try to really, you know, fully decipher, you know, the after effects or the, you know, the full range of health effects of SARS-CoV-2 infection, understand them mechanistically, and also try to reverse them, either prevent them from happening or reverse them in people who already got them. You know, humanity and we as a species, we've done a remarkable job advancing science on different fronts over the past several centuries. And we've solved much, much, much harder problems in the past. There is no reason that if we apply our might and intellect and creativity to COVID and long COVID, there's no reason to think that this will not be a solvable problem.
Dr. Alali, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Ziad Alali is the Chief of Research and Development at the VA St. Louis Healthcare System and Senior Clinical Epidemiologist at Washington University in St. Louis. And now it's time for the Quirks and Quarks listener question.
Question.
A listener posting as Jeff on X writes, how hot did the side of the moon that faced the sun get during the eclipse? And here's the answer.
Hi, my name is Nikhil Arora, and I'm an astrophysicist at Queen's University. The temperature of the side of the moon facing the sun remains exactly the same. And that's because for the moon, during a solar eclipse, there is nothing special. The moon is exactly at the same distance from the sun that it is at other times during the new moon phase, when it is between the Earth and the sun. And interestingly, the temperature of the moon facing the sun during just a regular during regular times is actually fairly hot. It's roughly 121 degrees Celsius during daytime. On the other hand, though, during the total solar eclipses, the temperature on the Earth, where you are in the shadow of the moon, does drop. So on April 8th, when we observed this great North American eclipse, from the beginning of the first contact to just before totality, the temperature on Earth for us dropped roughly 10 degrees. On the other hand, during a lunar eclipse, when the Earth is in the center blocking sunlight for the moon, the temperature of the moon facing the sun would get slightly lowered, but by a very small amount.
Nikhil Arora is an astrophysicist at Queen's University. And that's it for Quirks and Quarks this week. If you'd like to get in touch with us, our email is quirks@cbc.ca. Or just go to the contact link in our webpage at cbc.ca/quirks, where you can read my latest blog or listen to our audio archives. You can also follow our podcast or get us on the CBC Listen app. It's free from the App Store or Google Play. Quirks and Quarks is produced by Livia Dyring, Olsi Sorokina, Amanda Buckowitz, and Sonia Biting. Our senior producer is Jim Lebbins. I'm Bob McDonald. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.